What is peace brain? Peace brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Hello and welcome to the Peace Brain Show. This is your host, Dr. Gail Lash, and we're so happy to have you here today. Today we have an exciting topic. We're going to be talking about zoos and aquariums and how they can be places of peace and how they might need to change in the future as we go forward. So please stay tuned for our meditation as well at the end of the show. We always do a transformative meditation, and it will be around nature and that sort of thing. We'll just see where this flows. So today I have a guest, and I will introduce him in a minute, Jose Miguel Terrades, who is a zoo designer, a landscape architect. But first, as always on the Peace Brain Show, I open the show with a quote. And today we're going to be talking about the quote from Buckminster Fuller, who, I love this quote, who said, "You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." I just get chills when I hear this because it is very true. We can't just fight against the reality and hope to change it. We have to come up with something different, something new, something inspirational that people want to move towards and do, and it really does make the old model obsolete. So what Bucky said is very profound and is the way that we are creating this new world on the planet, a new world of prosperity and peace and power for all, that can really be in alignment with where our spirits want to go and where we want to go as a society and as a world citizenry. So today we're going to be talking about zoos and aquariums, and I know there's a lot of controversy around zoos and aquariums. We're here in the United States, and there is an organization that oversees and accredits all zoos and aquariums in the U.S. that choose to become a member, to become an accredited member of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And so those zoos are actually really pretty wonderful places for animals. They certainly have animal welfare as one of their top priority, as the top priority, but also conservation is one of the top priorities, as well as the educational and the entertainment aspects of zoos. But as we're evolving into zoos and aquariums, we've already gone through an amazing history of change from the menagerie of the 1700s, where kings and queens would keep an exotic list of animals, and they'd keep them in small cages and have one of each as an oddity to view. And then we had circuses, and then cities began to have the animals would stay after the circus left town or went bankrupt, and they would create a zoo. And so London Zoo was one of the first zoos in the world to be an official public zoo. And around the world, here in Atlanta, Georgia, our zoo was one of the first ones in the United States. It became a zoo in 1889. So zoos have gone from barred cages into a renaissance, if you will, of natural habitats back in the 1970s and then most recently in the 1990s, to be more where the people are walking through the same habitat as the animal. But I want to talk today with our guest, Jose Terrades, to really talk about where do zoos need to go next? What is the next evolution of zoos? Because as we've heard on the news, and you may felt in your own circles in your own family. Some of these species, such as dolphins and whales, are no longer acceptable to be held in captivity. So sanctuaries are being created. And so we're beginning to look at what is the purpose of zoos and how we can move forward to educate urban populations about animals around the planet and actually provide that personal experience that hopefully will touch the heart and inspire conservation and change so that animals can be protected around the planet in other countries that we may not have any control over or much control over. So with that introduction, and again, as Buckminster Fuller said, to change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. So we're here to talk with Jose Miguel Terrades, who is a landscape architect and zoo designer, just graduated from the University of Montreal in Quebec, Canada. And I want to welcome you, Jose, to the Peace Brain Show. Thank you for being on with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Gale.
You don't have to call me Dr. Gale, but yes, thank you. So what inspired you? Let's just start for a moment. What inspired you to get into landscape architecture and zoo design?
Well, I've been wanting to be a zoo designer for a long time now. I think it all started with the computer game Zoo Tycoon. So I got that for Christmas one time.
Yes.
And I started designing zoos on the computer in that game. And then I realized this is what I want to do with my life. So
<I've> been, that's awesome.
pursuing that, I found out that it was a real job. And yeah, that's what I want to do.
So what are the kinds of studies you've had to take to actually become, to be qualified to be a zoo designer?
Well, since zoos are mostly outdoors, you have to be a landscape architect. That's what most zoo designers are. So a landscape architect is like an architect, but for every outdoor space. So this includes parks, squares, zoos, theme parks, all sorts of things, national parks, private gardens. And then you sort of specialize yourself in zoo design, which you can't really do at school. You have to learn in the job or through internet or reading books. And so that's what I've been trying to do.
Excellent. So what are some of the projects you've worked on, or what has piqued your interest in zoo, you know, for actual zoo habitats so far?
Well, I've had the luck to get an internship at URSA International, and that's where I've done pretty much any zoo design work that I have done, which includes a little bit of work for Zoo Atlanta on their new savannah, which is a very nice way to, you know, a very nice intro into zoo design because you're already designing something quite big. And also at URSA International, I've had the luck of being able to participate in a way that's more concrete and less, let's say I don't feel like an intern because the firm is so small that I have contact with the bosses immediately. And that's really great. It's, you know, I can give in my input and I feel like it's actually taken into account.
So and that's, I know you've been really enjoying those projects and doing great work on them. What, could you kind of walk us through a little bit about what a zoo designer does?
Well, I guess you have to usually get a project, which is usually some sort of exhibit. The zoo determines what animals they're building for and what they want. So the zoo is usually the main client, and then there's a lot of talking with the keepers because the animal is also your client, because you want to make the animals feel at home and you want to encourage natural behaviors. And so it's sort of you're sort of balancing out several aspects of zoo design. So you have to design for the keepers who take care of the animals themselves, but also zoo guests, because the entire point of a zoo revolves around the guests. You want to educate them. You want to make them understand that conservation is important. So how does that translate into your design, and how do you communicate that through landscape architecture?
And so what are some of the steps of actually then, I know you're working on the new elephant exhibit at Zoo Atlanta and the expanded savanna, and then various other species that are connected to that. What is some of the sort of, if you will, technical process that has to be done to go from design to actual seeing the exhibit, you know, as a visitor?
Well, first thing you need is a survey. So a survey is essentially a plan of the existing. And then you have a mandate which tells you what the zoo wants to build. And from there you start conceptualizing an exhibit, which means you have to sort of organize into space the animal habitats and the guest experience. And usually that's a trail that goes through a chosen ecosystem. So you start conceptualizing that and seeing what you want to present and how you want to present it, to eventually start placing things and getting down to the technical details of captive animal management, which isn't easy because, you know, you have to, for example, the keepers and the animals don't really ever touch in most cases, so how do you manage an animal as big as an elephant in a safe manner? And eventually you get to, once that whole process is refined and you have a project, you get to construction documents which detail how to build what you've imagined. And then eventually you go into construction.
Fantastic. I know it's a long process, and it takes a lot of detail, a lot of meetings, lot of dialogue between all the players involved. So what do you like about zoos?
I think for me it's I enjoy building experiences. About zoos themselves, I really enjoy looking at the animals and sort of connecting to them on a personal level, which most zoo guests probably don't get to do. But I think if you start experiencing current zoos a little differently and you take your time and you really sort of are curious and start, you know, you open your eyes to these other species that share the planet with us, and you get to know them and you see their value, and that's what I like. I like sitting around the zoo and getting to know who we share this planet with.
Mm-hmm. And so that personal experience, that guest experience, is really important. And I know that in the way that we've designed zoos to be that where the person is walking, walking through the habitat with the animals, that brings a little bit more of that personal experience, that personal look. I see an okapi around the corner, or there's a leopard in the bush in front of me. How do we provide those kinds of personal experiences? What can be done now and better?
Well, what people have been trying to do for a while now is to get you to connect to the animals on a personal level. Mm-hmm. And for that to be achieved, in my opinion, I think you sort of need to create a space that is emotionally engaging, which would involve a sense of personal involvement and adventure, which I don't think is currently a thing that many zoos have. I think this is something that really needs to be worked on so we can get to a place where people where the zoo actually becomes what it's supposed to be, and people will actually have that connection. So how do we build that connection? I think is going towards individualized experiences or providing the basis for guests to build those experiences upon, which involves, again, adventure. So maybe creating a zoo environment that's a little more confusing, or that feels a lot more like you're out in the wild than they do right now, because right now I feel like most of it is designed to look like the wild, but none of it feels like the wild, because the zoo is a very controlled
place.
Yeah, and it's not, it's giving the illusion of anything could happen is what you want to do. Because then you get that thrill of, I'm out in the wild, I'm looking for animals, and then when you finally find an animal, I think you start observing it for a longer period of time, since it's the reward to your search, as opposed to what we have now, which is very simplistic. You know, guests walk along a path, and they can clearly tell where an animal is supposed to be, and they'll look at that animal for 8 seconds, and then they'll move on to the next thing.
Which is
sort of like the menageries were.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we're back in that menagerie mindset.
Yeah. The landscape immersion movement, in my opinion, has sort of turned very, has lost a bit of its purpose and has turned into simply an aesthetical thing. So the concepts like hiding barriers, which were important at the time to make people feel immersed in these habitats, have become simply aesthetic concepts where barriers are designed like rockwork, but they're still very much visible and they're very much identifiable as barriers.
So you know where the animal, even though you're in the environment, you know where the animal's range starts and stops, and you do feel very safe walking next to them or seeing them. And of course, when we look through glass at a viewing space, you know, the animal may be on the other side of the glass, but obviously there's glass between you, so it is very safe.
Yeah, everything is very predictable. And it doesn't involve a lot of engagement on the guest's part. It's almost like watching a TV show. You're just walking. You're walking through the zoo, and everything comes up to you. Really.
So let's talk about an ecotourism experience, because that's my background as well, is how to get people out into nature and give that personal, ecotour, that personal nature-based tour where you are walking in the actual wild, and normally there's a guide, although some are self-guided, but it's normally there's a guide that will point out little details along the journey. And you may be going to see, let's say, monkeys, for example, in the baboon sanctuary in Belize. They have this amazing trail, and you're probably out with a guide for an hour looking at medicinal plants, looking at termite mounds, looking at all kinds of different things in the forest before you get that personal up close with the monkey and get to break off a branch of leaves and feed the monkey right there. So you can literally touch the monkey and have that personal experience. It's an amazing experience, but the monkey experience is probably 10 minutes at the end of the hour. it's the whole journey of the product. So is that something like you're talking about here, transplanting to a zoo in a way?
Yes, it would be that type of experience, which is a lot more individualized, where you have the help of a guide instead of a sign, which I think, are probably very inefficient, zoo information panels. The guide is sort of, again, more interactive. And, the journey is part of the experience. Searching for the animal is part of the experience, and it makes it so much more rewarding when you finally find it and you actually take the time to get to know it. So, again, it's a lot more engaging, and if zoos could gravitate towards something like that, then it would be great. I think the problem, it's really a question of size and complexity. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, zoos have become too big. They have too many species. They're trying to do too much. They try to appeal to absolutely everybody. And this is probably because zoos don't make money. They have a lot of missions to fulfill in terms of conservation and education. And just keeping captive animals is a hard enterprise.
It's
so
expensive.
How?
Yes.
Yeah, it's expensive. So how do we create a new model in which we tone down the complexity of the zoo to something smaller, yet more engaging that fulfills its conservation and education purposes better, and make it economically viable?
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what the new zoo, if you will, and of course relating it to peace, because zoos are a place of peace that certainly showcase the biodiversity of the planet or the conservation of the biodiversity of the planet, and they allow the biodiversity of the diversity of the human race to come through its gates. So it is a place where we can learn, as you just said, to slow down, to appreciate nature, to find that inner dialogue, if you will, of oneness with nature. So what could that look like, Jose? What could a new peace zoo or a new zoo that is smaller, has less species, has these experiences look like?
Well, I think, first of all, the way that guests are taught things would be very different. Perhaps at the beginning of the zoo, you would have a short film which would tell you about the ecosystem or the animals you're about to see. And it would also tell you about zoo etiquette, which is something that is not...
not openly discussed.
Yeah, it's not something that is talked about, but if you're going into this environment with wild animals, you want to make sure that people respect them, and it's the perfect place to educate people about how to interact with wild animals, how to show them respect, how to so maybe zoos become quiet places where we get to meet other species in a respectful manner. So this also means what energy are we giving off to the animals that we're encountering. We don't want to threaten them. We don't want to frighten them. Because what I've noticed, for example, in aviaries, children tend to run after the birds and scream at them, which is the opposite of what we want. So
right.
how do we teach them to respect and to love these animals is part of the what the future of zoos should be.
Mm-hmm.
So that intro area, which would have not only the science information, but also how to act around animals, would then lead you to, let's say, an adventure trail, from which, I mean, you would have to explore perhaps over a relatively large distance, this environment, and try to find animals, so you can then look at them.
Would it be useful to have a guide, or could this be done by yourself?
I think both options are important. The guide is a wonderful tool, because if he's walking the trail, he can stop people and point things out that people wouldn't normally see. So, and tell people about them. So the guide is wonderful. However, I think it's also important for people to be able to do this on their own, I guess that's because that's what I do when I go. You know, I
tell us what you do.
Well, I quietly walk around, just me or with my girlfriend. And we take our time, and we look at things, and sometimes we turn back, and we go back to look at things that we didn't see before. And then oftentimes when we find something, we wait a while to see what will happen or what the animal is doing. That's how you see animal behavior. You can't expect to see the animal doing something in the few seconds that most people spend by it. So that's how you see the cool stuff is when you take your
time. So what's some of the cool stuff that you've seen?
Well, the other day I was in this aviary, and there was this jungle fowl that I noticed was kicking a bamboo stick around. And so I noticed that the bamboo stick was an enrichment item which had mealworms in it. So the jungle fowl was actively trying to get the mealworms out of the stick. It was really interesting, and it was also funny to watch. Also in the same aviary, we saw a lot of birds building their nests. So we saw them come to the ground, pick out branches, go back to the tree, and try to fit them in. Oftentimes they would drop back to the ground, and the bird would come back for the same branch. He really liked that branch. So it's that kind of thing. And in another aviary, I sat still for a little bit, and this Victoria pigeon came over and started. He was very curious about my bracelets and I think my arm hair, and he started exploring it and sort of pecking lightly at it. And it was, you know, that's the kind of personal experience you want people to have,
mm-hmm.
You know, because then you start relating to the animal and you start loving the animal, and you want to take that love and do something with it.
Good point. No, thanks for sharing those. So it's not only, I know in most zoos we have, you know, domestic animals that obviously kids and parents, people can walk into and pet and brush and actually touch and be close to, or in aquariums, the touch tank. So those are givens to have that personal touch. But I like what you just shared about an aviary, for example. Just by taking your time, you are actually in the animal space and can have an interaction with the animal, or at least even by watching the animal do something, like build the nest or work with the bamboo stick and the mealworms, that is a personal experience. Even though you're not physically touching them, you are physically engaging and mentally engaging with them in watching their behavior. So those could be done. That could be done with larger, you know, animals, or animals that certainly the public can't go in with. Just watching some of their behaviors would also be engaging.
Yeah. And keeper talks, for example, to go back to the sort of the guided tour aspect, are great, because you get to learn about the animal from an actual person, and not a sign that tells you things that, in my opinion, are pretty useless, like the animal's height and weight. I mean, that those things don't matter, really. So when you go see a keeper talk, you get to see the animal doing things, and maybe that's a more accessible way for people to do it at first than exploring on their own. So it's a facilitator.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I will say, I have to laugh, in a way where you said the height and weight don't matter. As a scientist, I go, well, wait a minute. I want to know the height and weight. I want to, quote, compare the animal to me. And oh, they're bigger than me, or they're smaller than me, or whatever. It just gives me a reference point for that. So, I hear you. And I guess it depends on the individual of what is important.
It certainly does. But I think for the conservation issues, the broader issues, what you need to learn is more about how the animal interacts with its environment and how that's important and why we need these animals on a broader scale, more than just the particular species. Yeah.
So you bring something to the forefront, and this is, I want to go with this, is how the animal interacts with their environment and what's going on in the environment. That brings in the human as well. In other words, most of the time animals interacting in their environment, something is going on where humans have changed that environment, or humans are affecting the environment and, of course, the conservation of the animals. So, for example, the California condor back at the Los Angeles Zoo when I was there, they had one California condor in an exhibit at the zoo to teach the public about what was going on in the wild, that at the time there were only, I want to say, 20 birds left or maybe less in the whole world, and because they only exist in California. And the zoo had taken eggs and was helping hatch them out and raise them up and put them back out into the wild. And so this is an opportunity in many of these instances when we watch animal behavior to start to talk about how have humans impacted these animals and what are the issues that are really going on in the human world that perhaps we can find new solutions for. So would you advocate putting in the new kinds of zoos we're talking about, or transforming zoos, to start to talk about, have dialogue about these human issues and community solutions for them?
Yeah, I think that's clearly a crucial part of it. You can't just tell people that things are going badly and then not explain why and not explain how we can make them better. Because the point is making them better. So the whole how this environment ties in to us people is extremely important. That's what the education is for, is to make sure that we eventually become more one with nature than we are now. That's the goal of the whole thing.
And I know that's a big task, because that means changing just about everything that humans are doing on the planet. I mean, seriously. And you are, I want to explore this for just a moment, or a little bit along those lines. You are what's classified as a millennial in your age group. And I know millennials here in the United States, and I realize you're from Canada, but in the United States, there are 80 million millennials out of, I believe, some around 300 million U.S. citizens. So clearly quite a huge group in the U.S. population and, of course, around the world as well. How are millennials looking differently at zoos these days, and what kind of zoo are they actually wanting to create? And I know you're just one representative of that group, but could you speak a little bit to that?
Well, from what I notice when I talk to people my age, everybody is automatically against zoos because they keep animals in captivity. So I think to convince them that zoos have a place in the world, zoos need to be impeccable and also be able to justify very precisely why each species, or maybe even every individual animal that is in their institution, is there. So this means, for example, a zoo that I know of that's pretty hard to criticize is the Echo Museum in Montreal, because they only have local animals, and the individuals that represent those species at the zoo are all rescues, so they can't be released. So this becomes sort of a sanctuary for them, but at the same time gets to be an opportunity to educate people. So it's all about having direct tie-ins between the animals at the zoo and the real world of conservation outside the zoo. So you need to justify everything very clearly and very well to convince.
So what would that look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, that might look like, again, a zoo that is downscaled to fewer species, because right now they have too many species for no particular reason other than the show of it. So let's say you're trying to recreate a certain environment, then you would have maybe a handful of species that together sort of make a good picture of that environment. And then because you decided to build that specific environment at the zoo and teach people about it, you would do field work related to that specific environment, which would be, you know, the conservation tie-in. The other option is to have very zoos with local wildlife, which means that they can act directly near the zoo on the local wildlife and the local ecosystems, as opposed to having some sort of long-term exotic animal breeding plan, which is probably economically very hard to do because these big animals are hard to maintain. I'm sort of losing track here. But
so if it was a local species, obviously the zoo could help the local community work on policies and ways to work with their local parks and natural areas to preserve them, and what human use could be in those areas, and how development might be created in their city or town that would impact or hopefully not impact the wildlife, etc. Correct?
Yeah, exactly. It would be a more direct link between in situ conservation and ex situ conservation,
right.
Because then the zoo being so close to the wild habitat of the animals they're housing can become, for example, a breeding center, and can release animals a lot in a, you know, way more easily than breeding to eventually release African animals.
Go ahead. Well, let's talk about release for a moment, because many times zoos do have a very successful history of breeding animals, but then where do you put them? You know, this has been the challenge of many different species, because zoos actually can accomplish that, but to put them back into the wild, first of all, the animals have to be trained because they've only been raised in captivity. They don't know the wild. But then many times, and this is the general case, the wild is not there anymore because humans have taken it away, you know, cut it down, burned it, built on it, etc., farmed on it, etc. So around the world, I know zoos have put in conservation programs that help with the local communities, not just setting aside conservation land for the animals in that area, but help to build schools and education programs and dig wells and create opportunities, you know, through like Kiva and other, you know, women's entrepreneurial enterprises to help uplift the human population so that the pressures on the wild population won't be so great. So that, as you said, is something that zoos can do to start to look at the human situation that impacts these buffer zones or these sanctuaries, these reserves and parks in other countries and foreign areas, that we're trying to preserve. But unless the humans there want to preserve it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. So it's sort of fixing the problem at its roots.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the holistic approach, is if you can't necessarily protect something forever, you need other people to care about it, and you need to make them value it. So that's sort of going back to ecotourism. That's probably one of the ways that it's usually done, is you teach people that these animals are valuable and that they're things that people want to see, and they can make money off of them. So then it becomes their livelihood, and they start protecting them, and you reduce the pressures that way.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So all that we've talked about so far, actually, some of that is being done, or all of it, some is being done in some zoos, and then many zoos are doing partial pieces of what we've discussed. I want to go just a bit further and really stretch the envelope and talk about peace zoos. And that would be getting back to really, you're talking about this ethics or this way that we respect animals. It would be, in my mind here, and I'll just paint a picture and then love your input on this, is that a zoo is a sanctuary in the beginning. When someone walks in the door, it would be about learning, you're correct, what we talked about, being quiet, being present with nature, being in that silence. And, of course, kids have to run around and burn off energy and all of that, so there's probably going to have to be places where they can run and play and make noise and explore the environment, et cetera. But by and large, it's like walking through a forest in a very sacred manner and really being engaged in the moment, whether you have a guide or not, and probably a guide would certainly keep people focused on being engaged, that one start to realize in that experience how to find that quiet place inside of oneself. And that's so important, I believe, to find that peace within oneself, to be able to bring it out into our community. We can't have a peaceful community if each of us is always anxious and angry and busy and, you know, not engaged within ourselves. So zoos have an opportunity, I think, to be a place where they actually, if people can practice being at peace. People can practice being one with nature and being respectful and loving oneself and loving nature and loving all of humanity at the same time. So that when they leave the zoo, they can hopefully bring that back to their community. This is the point. And I would love to see zoos actually be a forum, to be for places of dialogue and communication about issues that are happening in the world and certainly within your own community, like bullying in schools, and how do we stop that? How can we find acceptance of, quote, the other, unquote, and people who are different than us? And that doesn't mean we're less than, you know, if someone else is different. So how do kids address bullying, and how can animals teach us to be at peace? And then that can morph into, how do we stop actual the wars around the planet? Because many times the wars are basically, well, they're certainly about power and economics, but they also are bullying, if you will. You know, it's the subjugation of others that wars are all about. So why do we as a human feel the need to do that? Nature is about balance, and even though you have predators and prey in zoos and, you know, and in nature, you have balance. That's the balance of nature, and so it's how do we bring our humanity back to balance? Because conservation cannot happen without peaceful human societies and without peace in the area and with economic prosperity and everyone has enough, you know, poverty has to be alleviated, etc. So the United Nations has put out these 17 Sustainable Development Goals for 2030 to create a new world. And I encourage all of you listeners to look it up, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals for 2030. But zoos can teach this, could have dialogue around it, could actually have places where you could find peace and learn that respect toward animals, sit down and talk to the animals, you know, like you did with the pigeon and the jungle fowl, et cetera. So, what are your thoughts on all that, Jose?
Well, I think the zoo is certainly a place that can become a place of relaxation in nature. You know, that this whole idea that spending time out in nature is very good for us, and is very soothing and alleviates stress levels. So that's the first connection between peace and zoos. And then, as you said, if we could shift the current zoo atmosphere, which oftentimes tends to be chaotic because there's a lot of people and you really feel that there are a lot of people and there are a lot of children running around, which is normal, but if we could create something that's more relaxed and more soothing for people, then that would be great. And then we could teach them, again, the respect of the other, which in this case is another species, and how to sort of learn to live with our differences. At the same time, then you, as you were saying, the whole aspect that for conservation to work, usually the region that you're trying to preserve must be at peace. Everybody must have enough. So that goes back to the holistic approach we were talking about earlier. So how do you have to teach that conservation is not just taking a wild space and putting a fence around it and closing it off to people. Conservation involves local communities, and you need those local communities to be in a good state, out of poverty, and they have to be at peace for them to be able to value these wild environments, because you can't expect them to protect these animal species that, for example, they're forced to eat because they don't have enough food. So how do you create this, well, this peaceful world
mm-hmm.
to allow you?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the whole. You have to attach conservation issues to human issues. So
mm-hmm.
you're right. You're very right when you say that peace is extremely important to conservation.
So I know we're getting toward the end of our time. Do you think that millennials and or people your age would accept zoos when they begin to talk about the human condition in connection with the animal condition?
Yes, but I think, again, the reason for the animal's presence at the zoo has to be very justified,
mm-hmm.
is a basic impression that I have about how to make millennials accept zoos, but also obviously showing, you know, all these human connections is also very important.
Go ahead.
I think we can change their minds. It's doable. I've done it before.
I know you've talked to your friends about it, because obviously you're pro zoo, and besides rescue, though, besides an animal that can't go back into the wild, what is a justification? Being an ambassador for the conservation efforts that zoos are actually tied into that species, or what else?
Yes, the needs of the animal have to be met extremely well. So the animal has to be obviously treated extremely well. So this means not only veterinary care and appropriate food and stuff, but also things like having choice over their own lives and having complex environments and being mentally stimulated. So that's the first thing. And then once that is met, you have to have that tie-in, as you were saying, into what the zoo is doing outside the zoo. So you have to show people that this animal is an ambassador and is not simply an animal that was chosen by the curator just to add another species and to, you know, because the bird was colorful or whatever, and then you wanted to attract more people to the zoo.
Mm-hmm. That makes
sense.
So
it's really about being able to point to conservation initiatives that directly relate to those animals or the animal's ecosystem.
Okay. Well, thank you. Any last words you want to provide our listeners today?
Maybe question everything.
Question everything.
Yeah, that's an important. Yeah, that's important. So, you know, if you want to shape the future, you got to look at things and see what you like and what you don't like, and based on what you don't like, try to change things and better them.
Well, we look forward to you changing zoos in the future and making them amazing new places that really are in harmony with our human society and the animal society and the world at large. So thank you, Jose. I really appreciate you being on the Peace Brain Show today. Where can people find out more about you? Do you have a website? Or
no,
LinkedIn?
I don't have a website.
Not yet.
That's a good question. Yeah, no, not yet. Well, I guess they can ask Ursa International, the company, if they ever want to get in touch with me.
Okay.
That would be the easiest way. And my zoo design work is
right
through Ursa International.
Well, and that is URSA, and then international spelled out, .org. And thank you again, Jose Miguel Terrades, for being on the Peace Brain Show. And now we'll go
thank
into
you.
Our... It's been a delight. I appreciate it. We will go into the Peace Brain meditation for the last few minutes we have here. I invite you all to just close your eyes and be present. Take a breath. Take a breath. And think about what you just heard. Animals and people are intricately connected. And so I invite you to see yourself with all the animals of the earth and honoring them. They are co-species here on the planet with us. Yes, we humans seem to be in charge of the planet, and yet Mother Earth lets us know many times that we are not. But we need to exist with all of these species. Actually, our human safety and success and prosperity depends on the diversity of the other species on the planet. We could not live here without them. So send your love and appreciation to all the animals, the plants, the insects on the planet, all living beings. And then visualize a zoo in front of you, in a zoo in the new sense, a zoo that has animals who are really here to teach humans how to be better humans, that are here to help humanity uplift itself and become more respectful, more at one with the earth, to certainly uplift humans out of the terrible conditions that we've created here on the planet into ones of well-being and prosperity and love and unity. We can learn from the animals. So see the animals in these urban institutions teaching people, where they, of course, are feeling cared for and loved and in perfect well-being. and that they are tied to their counterparts in the parts of the world where they actually came from and originated. That their presence in the urban societies is helping to connect humans with their counterparts in their wild places, where humans and animals can exist in harmony and beauty and balance. And so send love and appreciation to these animals who are in partnership with humans in these urban centers that we call zoos or aquariums or sanctuaries. And feel the personal experience that you can have with the animals, both at these institutions, at these places, and places where you can find peace, as well as with the animals actually in the wild, in their own habitats. Send them love, and then feel the love returning back to you and your heart. Breathe it in, and be at peace with yourself and with the animals around the planet. And now open your eyes, take a breath, bring yourself back to your chair or wherever you are. And I want to thank you for tuning in today to the Peace Brain Show and listening to our guest, Jose Miguel Terradas from Montreal, Canada. And remember, if you would like to connect with us about peace and zoos, you can find out more about me, Gail Lash, at tourismforpeace.com, or you can email me at hello@peacebrain.org. And I'd love to hear more about you and your thoughts and comments and how you would like to create peace in this world. And so again, thank you, Jose, for being on the show, and I want to ask now all of you to please go forth and activate your peace brain and put your mark on the World Peace Trails map. Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.